Let me briefly introduce Gijsbert Ellekens, our speaker of today. Gijsbert has been an associate professor at the Department of Pedagogical and Educational Sciences at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, here in Europe. He was a manager and coordinator of different degree programs in educational science up to 2012, when he at least partially retired. But he's still very active and was a co-editor recently of a very, well, we hope that this one will be very influential in the future, and a special issue on CSCL in educational psychologists. And he also wrote a great chapter there, or a great article there, on proposing a new framework basically for CSCL. He earned a Master's of Science in Developmental Psychology at the University of Amsterdam and a PhD in Social Sciences from Utrecht University. His PhD project, this is what I learned from his CV, for his PhD project he applied methods of artificial intelligence and programmed an artificial intelligence program that simulated a cooperative student that was able to collaborate with human students. So from then, a long series of projects, a long series of awards, and also influential contributions to conferences, he is now, or for us today, he's focusing on one of his main research focuses, that is automated analysis of argumentation. I would like to invite Gijsbert to take the floor and maybe speak a little bit in addition to what I said about your own biography, giving us your own perspective on your trajectory through developmental psychology through social sciences to psychology and computer-supported collaborative learning. Gijsbert, we are very much looking forward to your talk.
Thank you for your nice introduction. I'm Gijsbert Ellekens, I'm from Utrecht University. I'm just pensioned, so I'm looking after my grandchildren, my grandson a lot, but I do still do some research. As you said, I started in developmental psychology, and I did some studies on, actually on interaction as well, on mother-child interaction, how sort of mathematical modeling of interaction process between mothers and very small infants. And then I started to educational psychology and educational science, and was interested in interaction process as well. So my whole career I was busy in interaction and that sort of thing. And I especially mentioned my PhD thesis because in making a computer program, a simulation program that can collaborate with a human student, you will encounter a lot of problems. And a lot of problems I encountered then were actually the starting point of this idea of automatic coding and argumentation analysis in this way. So that's why I mentioned that. So I will think I will come to that also. I will try to do it a little bit more general. If you look at slide 2, the setup of the seminar, I will speak on communicative markers in collaboration dialogues and or other human interaction. Not only argumentative, but also on some other things, because I think that one of the specific things in our, in this course in human interaction is that people are giving signals not only about information, about content, but also about quite a lot of other things. So we speak a little bit about communicative markers. Then, well, the subject is automatic coding. So I will discuss our approach on that. There are other approaches as well. as you already mentioned, Caroline Rosé, somebody mentioned her. Dialogue acts and argumentation, the way we look at dialogue acts and specific to argumentative dialogue acts we try to specify. Something about reliability and validity, and the use of automatic coding, because it's not only for analysis, but you can use it also from some other perspectives. These five topics I would like to discuss with you, and if you agree, of course. I will try to have some discussion in every topic, so that you can have some, so we can have some real discussion, some real collaboration, actually. So if you, I'm not sure if I can start now.
Yes, I think if everyone has the slides and there are no questions, it would be great if you could just start. So everyone, well, okay, Gijsbert.
Thank you. So please, if you have some questions on some remarks, please show your hands on the slide. So I will stop immediately if you want to interrupt. That would be nice if you want to do that. So I continue now to the third slide, and we will discuss something about what are communicative markers. I on my fourth slide, I entered the dialogue fragment, a little piece of our research. And I would like to have you look at this fragment and see what you think of that. What's happening in the dialogue? What's relevant for collaboration, you think? What's the process of collaboration? The style of collaboration? Everything you think is interesting also from your perspective, from your research project. The dialogue fragment on slide 4 is from three girls, and they're 16, 17 years in high school, preparatory for university, and they're in the curriculum history, and they have to write an essay on strong women in antiquity. And so they have sources about Andromache, Electra, and that sort of thing. And they also have to do interviews with strong women now. And mostly they are aunts or grandmothers and that sort of thing. Then those people. And so they have to compare that. Would we still think that strong women in antiquity are the same kind of strong woman as we would define it now? So they have to write an argumentative essay in the end. They have different sub questions, and this part, this fragment, is about sub question 1b. What did the strong woman do? It's about Andromache, which is, I don't know if I pronounce it correctly, but she was married with Hector in the Trojan War and was conquered, but that's not important, I think. So please, would you read this dialogue fragment and say what you think of them. I will wait some minutes and then we will discuss that. So what do you think of the fragment?
I have a question. Are all of them women, or are male participants also
interested? Yes, I don't know if it's relevant, but it's true. There are three girls.
So maybe we just take a start, and we read that, and the first thing that came to our minds was that they really don't talk about the same things, what you see further in the end, where the one girl, 506, wants to know something about the content, and the others just have remarks about if it's written with a C or a K.
And we're also thinking about that. It's not really about the content question, but more about feedback or task coordination. So it's very interesting, rather from a social coordination perspective, but less from the content perspective. Yes.
I was thinking that it seems like there's some reassurance happening. So it strikes me as being about social relations, that the two people giving feedback weren't really looking very deeply at what the third person was doing and was just assuming it was a point for offering reassurance.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really fully agree with what you all mentioned. It's not that much about content. It's more about task coordination and what's really asked about the task. But it's also about reassuring the others. No, girl, it's not. It will be fine what you did. And I'm very sorry to give some criticism. They're very careful with each other. So it's also social relational. There are several cues. And there's a little bit discussion about content, which is actually the difference between what is the deed of somebody and what's the difference with at the end, the role in society. Is there a difference in opinion? Because another sub question is about the role in society. So they're actually discussing about that. So there are some content matters, but there are also some quite other matters of coordination. So I think that's what you find in a lot of dialogues in the collaboration, that the children are speaking about a lot more than only content. They are trying to coordinate the task. They're trying to be to keep their friendship alive. They're trying to get their motivation on the level, and sometimes when it's not working, they maintain that. But if it's not working, they will speak explicitly about it. But in a lot of cases, it's very implicit, and it's very about little things like, no, girl, of course not. It's probably okay. I'll read it now. They are helping each other and that sort of thing. So on the social aspect. So if you look at the slide number 5. My idea is that when you ask students to collaborate on a task, they're not only collaborating on and coordinating the task content, their approach, and getting agreement about this approach and this strategy, but also they're talking about how to collaborate and discussing that the task division, negotiation, the integration of new information to each other. And sometimes they have communicational problems. They don't understand each other. They have different ideas about some concepts. They have to try to get a sort of common ground, of course, and it's also a coordination task. And they have to keep their social relation on the level, on a kind level, as everybody knows who collaborate. So you have some idea of to be friendly or polite. And in this case, I understand the question, are these all girls? They are very friendly to each other in this case, and we see that mostly. Of course, motivation. It's strange, but it's remarkable that in collaboration, if you have a motivational problem, sometimes we see in the chats things like, oh, I don't like this task, it's really boring, I don't want to do that. Actually, the students are giving a coordination problem. They have a problem of motivation, not individual, but they have shared the problem. One of the persons has a motivational problem. So it's becoming a general or shared problem, and they have to solve that. And perhaps also for emotion, getting frustration or getting a lot of emotional background. So I think that in collaboration, students have to solve a lot more tasks than only the task at hand, but also on this collaboration and other layers. Furthermore, they solve these problems sometimes very explicitly and directly, or sometimes on a metacognitive level, but also very implicit on a very short and small kind of things, being kind to each other and that sort of thing. So the coordination platform, I think, is the dialogue, and people, and by multifunctionality of language, we can do a lot of things on different layers at the same time. That's my idea. Good. At slide 6, students are giving markers, sometimes of really linguistic markers, which are called discourse markers. You have also content markers, in which they maintain these coordination problems, these coordination tasks on the different levels. So on the task content, of course, they have concepts like dilemma in this example, or deeds, or strong woman, or antiquity, or role in society, which are concepts they use. And they use that we can recognize that if they use that sort of kind of language. But they have also a lot of uncertainty about things. One of the articles I suggested to read is an article of Jordan and others, which is very about how people give markers about their certainty of knowledge. I think that there's a sort of that. It's probably this. In my PhD research, we were studying primary school children solving a puzzle, and it was remarkable how much of the uncertainty markers were transferred. Every exchange, they were talking about how sure they were or how unsure they were about their knowledge or about the ideas. I think it's a very important thing if you think of interaction and a collaboration as a knowledge constructing process, that you look at also the uncertainty of these processes. On collaboration things, you can see markers like we should do this, or you should do that, and I should do that on task division. And I have some marks from very, very small phrases you could look at and see how they coordinate or regulate their collaboration. Of course, there's also argumentative things like, but I don't know why, no, sorry, but, or because, or however, all these kinds of little markers that suppose or that suggest that the speaker is giving a sort of argumentative structure in his speech, in his utterance, that the utterance is meant to be argumentative. On a communicative level, sort of understanding, what do you say, do you really, what do you mean, what? Social relational, all these things, I think, which is very interesting to look at things, or the use of personal pronouns like I or you or we should this do this. I think it would be very interesting to look at that sort of markers. Motivational things like negative evaluative utterances or positive utterances, and things on an emotional level like frustration, use of exclamation marks, use of smileys, and that sort of thing. So I think that in a dialogue, in collaboration, a lot of markers are giving with the utterance, which are going further than only the content, but also working on these different layers of coordination. So I stop and I ask you.
Heisberg, I think your question was somehow masked or cut off in the end of your turn. Could you repeat the question? And also welcome to this link group. You can download the slides for this session. You see the link in the Dropbox link in the chat. We have no video image of you currently, but maybe you can try out a bit later.
Sorry, I was too quick. I was asking, what do you think of that? If, do you agree or do you have comments on this? So that was my question.
And just because you mentioned the smileys, you see the smileys on the lower right, in the lower right corner, quite close to the chat. You can also use these if you don't want to speak and just want to indicate that you understood or have not understood. You can use these smileys. There are more smileys under the voting tab. There is this one and also this one, and so you can use them also to give some back channeling for some information for back channel for Gijsbert.
So I'm dependent on smileys. I will continue if you give me smileys. So if you agree on that, then we will continue and we talk a little bit about automatic coding. But please, if you have problems with what I say, please interrupt. I think there are two ways to automatic coding. One way is what could be called knowledge tree, which are computer programs like data mining or pattern mining, which are actually trying to find regularities in, for example, discourse or dialogues or texts on a linguistic level, and try to find patterns which are common, for example, by collaborating or less collaborating children. That has some advantages, a lot of advantages. Caroline Rose is somebody who does that in her research. The nice thing is that it's not dependent on a language. You can use the same program for English, German, French, or whatever. Another approach is that you use some knowledge about, some linguistic knowledge about a language, which are called knowledge-based automatic coding, in which you use, you're trying to find predefined patterns. How do you know these patterns? Because you have some knowledge about how a language is operating. Of course, the disadvantage is that you are language specific. My program, we will talk in a minute, is in Dutch, so it won't be very useful in English. And that's a disadvantage, of course, but perhaps you'll find other disadvantages, other things about automatic coding. Perhaps you don't like automatic coding totally or fully. So I would like to have some discussion about, well, what do you think about automatic coding? Is that interesting, or don't you think it's interesting? Or coding by a computer program? And what do you think about these two kinds of special approaches? So I wait some minutes for you to react on this. So this is also a discussion question.
I have one question. Is the idea of this automatic coding to give, like, in real time feedback of the arguments of the students, or is for the to assess after the discussion is held?
Yes, it's possible to use automatic coding also in online feedback. Actually, we will discuss that at the end of the presentation. But in most situations, automatic coding is used for analysis kind of purpose.
So I imagine that in knowledge-free automatic coding, it would be more difficult to assess in real time.
but in knowledge-based approach is easier.
I'm not sure if that's a real difference. I think people in the knowledge-free coding would disagree, because they say, well, our program will run in whatever situation, even if you speak Chinese or whatever language. So perhaps they will not.
So I think with the knowledge-free approach, you will always let your program, for example, LightSight, run on your data, but after the computer did the analysis and made its own model, you have to look very, very carefully into your data and see what the computer defined for which variable for the coding. And of course, the computer makes some errors because it can't see if this word was meant in this meaning or in the second meaning it has. And the knowledge-based approach, there you have to like think beforehand, what utterances do you want to have, what patterns do you want to use for which, and there's a whole lot of more effort in the beginning. For example, with the work of Anderson with the automated tutors, cognitive tutors, he has to think about all the different ways how you could solve a math task beforehand, and if you didn't say this is a possible way, the program will say no, you did a wrong answer. And I mean, this is a bit similar. You have to really predefine every single possibility how you could do this, if I understand it right, at least.
Yes, I think that you make a very important point, that a lot of interpretation in knowledge-free automatic coding is afterwards. You have to look at all these patterns and see if you can interpret this on the right way, but it can also be very surprising. It's a sort of general seeking and finding new discoveries. In knowledge-based automatic coding, you do a lot of interpretation beforehand, so you will find the things you are looking for, and that's similar, of course, with a lot of other coding systems, but I think that's a very big difference. Thank you.
I was wondering if the framework of CERL was used in knowledge-based approach.
As I understood your speech, the framework of CERL about speech acts was not. Fully used. I did some recommendations, but I will talk about that in a minute. So we use that, but in a little bit different way. Thank you. No, I don't think so. So we continue. If you look at slide 8. If you think about observational analysis, you have some different approach. You have a more qualitative approach and a more quantitative approach, more interpretative and a more statistical way of doing things. And I always wonder about the different demands that we talk about if we do the different approaches. So sometimes I really wonder about that. I think that a more qualitative and interpretive analysis is very necessary, especially in the first stage. You have to interpret your data and look at it from a not a theoretically free standpoint, but without any stereotypes and that sort of thing. Of course, in a qualitative approach is the problem of subjectivity. As we all know, and a little bit of problem about bias searching, you're looking for special things to find, and you're very happy if you find them and that sort of thing. There is another approach of systematic coding, in which you try to have a sort of coding system and have a lot of counts of how much these codings are, how frequent they are, and that sort of thing. Then you have some other problems, which you actually also in qualitative approaches, like the unit of coding. What's the unit? Is that an utterance, or is it a whole chat message, or is it smaller than that? Is it a phrase? That's called the segmentation problem. And there are some 17 from the 1970s, there was a lot of discussion about observation about the exhaustiveness, exclusiveness, and independence of coding, which means that every code should be exclusive to other codings, coding categories, should also be exhaustive. Everything should be coded, and every code category should be independent of other code categories. I think it's a pity that we don't discuss these things anymore, or don't seem to be important, because I don't read it anymore. But in for example, in other fields like ethology, animal psychology, they do a lot of observation, and they still discuss these things of demands in the coding system. Of course, you have the reliability problem. How reliable should another researcher have the same kind of system, have the same results, and the validity problem, which is actually not very much researched. So I think the advantage of automatic coding, it's not a solution for everything, but it can have some advantages of coding protocols. We have the problem of robustness, which is meant that you have to be specific in the unit of coding. So if you change your coding from an utterance to a phrase or a subphrase, your coding system is not very robust. You have the problem of reliability. Is the coding the same every time you do it? Well, I did a lot of hand coding in my time, and I can assure you, if you are very exhausted, very tired, that your coding will change over the time, and you will get some other results. Actually, you do it a little bit different every time you do it. And of course, it's very labor intensive. So another advantage of automatic coding could be that it's less tiring, more robust. It's doing the same thing all over, always. And it has some reliability in the sense of stability. If you run the program twice over a protocol, you will get exactly the same result, which is not the case with hand coding. So if you agree on that, well, you don't have to agree, but if you accept that, we can go to the automatic coding of commutative function. I try to explain to you that there are other markers which are quite interesting, like uncertainty or like personal engagement, like I and you, but we are focusing now on commutative function. Every utterance, as Watzlawick already said in the 70s, every utterance has a content message, but also a relational message, which is the pragmatic function. What do I mean with my utterance to the other person? And that's what the commutative function is. So every utterance has a commutative function, fulfills a pragmatic action, which is actually, Searle was already mentioned. Searle did distinguish speech acts like assertives, directives, commands, commissives, expressive, and declaration. We have a little bit different system, but the idea is it's the same. Every utterance has some message also, which signals the way the utterance should be interpreted by the other. And this pragmatic function of utterances, it's called pragmatic, is signaled by what's called discourse markers. It's a very nice book by Schifrin in 1987 about a lot of discourse markers, like words like oh, or by the way, or well, or so, however. And on my list was also another article, not only by Schifrin, but also by, let's see, Byron and him, which used the same kind of discourse markers, a very short article. So these discourse markers are used to support the coherence in discourse. They give some meta message about what the message is really is trying to achieve to the other, and how the utterance should be interpreted in the context of the ongoing discourse. Well, now you get the commercial. It's not meant to be a commercial, but it's the program we use to do automatic coding. You can see on the next slide, slide 10, it's the MIPA program, which is a sort of program I made to support coding of protocols. What you can see on the slide is different columns and different lines, and the lines are protocol utterances. You can see them on the right side, and you have four coding variables columns in which you can specify a coding system and use that. It's for manual coding, and you have actor variables and that sort of thing. It's not commercial, it's just a joke, but if you it's this program, and you can see on the slide 11, it's actually I made it, this program, because I couldn't afford a more expensive program, so I thought, well, I make mine myself, and it has somehow some other facilities which I missed in some commercial programs. So it can do interaction analysis on a qualitative, but also on a statistical basis. It has a lot of statistical programs like cross tabulation, frequencies, lexisequential analysis, sorting, visual chart, word concordance, which is actually a sort of keyword method. It's multidimensional. You can have more dimensions of variables of coding, and it has some. It's an explorative environment. In a lot of commercial programs, I found it very annoying that you had to specify your observation in front. And in this MIPA program, you can do it online. That is, you can add categories or delete categories as you wish, and it will still. And you can do analysis from the first moment that you start coding. So that's what I liked. It's just a sort of amateuristic program. I programmed in the evenings, so it is not very commercial. And if you can, if you want to, you can use it. Just mail me, and you will get a link to the website, and you can use it. But it has also another feature, and that's you can specify a sort of program of automatic coding. And it's automatic coding, or semi-automatic coding, it can also suggest coding. It's very simple. It is what's called in artificial intelligence, it's sort of production rule system. You can specify production rules, we call it filters in the MIPA program. If you see this phrase, for example, if you see but in an English utterance, perhaps it is a counter argument, so coded as a counter argument. And so you can, a lot of these small words, which are these discourse markers, to code to code that and to give a code to that utterance. That's a little bit complicated than I mentioned now, but that's the whole idea. So you can specify things in the utterance and give an automatic code in that and run these filter files, as they are called, as production systems, on your new dialogues and see what codings are automatically coded. It's a very simple system, I think, in principle, and it's very helpful, not only for full automatic coding, but also for semi-automatic coding, that is, it can suggest coding. Actually, I started to do this because I was hand coding a lot of protocols, and I was really annoyed that I heard or read a question mark, and I was coding it as a question, which I found really a bit stupid, you know, because it's quite obvious that you think, oh, it's a question. So I thought, well, if you can see the question, just code it, the question mark, just code it as question. And actually, I found that if I started to code, if I tried to make a reliable coding, I had to be very specific, because another person had to code the same system, the same observation system. So if I try to be more concrete, actually I was developing a sort of standard rules how to code things. And if it's very standard, a computer program can do that as well. So that's the idea. Do you have questions or remarks? Then we go to the third theme. I don't see any negative smileys and no question marks, so I continue. Thank you. I was asking for that, sorry. Well, so now we will continue to our system of automatic coding. If you look at slide 12, dialogue act and argumentation, I said dialogue act and argumentation because we code dialogue acts, this communicative function, and one of the aspects is the argumentatives. Argumentatives are defined as all kinds of discourse markers which specify the argumentative function, like a reason or a contra argument or a consequence or a disjunct or a conjunct or elaboration. So they are actually used to convince the other person. They're meant to be convincing. But there are also other utterances like informatives, just giving some information to the other. There are responsives, which are meant to give some feedback of the other person, reacting to the other. There are elicitives, like a question, but also a proposal, let's do this, which is meant to get some reaction for the other, are specific meant to get a reaction from the other. And there are imperatives, and they're not very common in collaboration, I must say, but things like let's do this or do this and do that, there are commands. And they're similar to the speech acts of Searle, as you can see. So what we are looking at is different little marks, little for the argumentatives, like words like however or but or because. And of course you can ask yourself, well, is every use of but or because really meant to convince somebody else? So please think about that. That's my question. Is an argumentative marker like that really meant to do that? So please discuss that or think.
I just wanted to suggest that there probably are other functions that might signify as about to occur. So for example, you might have somebody playing devil's advocate. So rather than trying to convince the other person of something, they might just be suggesting. So you might have to kind of look at like the valence, or I guess the purpose of the statement. That's the first thing that comes to mind, is that might not be purely about convincing, but rather suggesting, I guess.
Rob, actually, it sounds like a robot in a helicopter. Sorry, there's no sound getting through. Maybe you reconnect, and that might work better. But you, I think your point is in the chat, and maybe Gijsbert can react to Nicole's and Ron's point as soon as Ron is back.
Yes. Well, I fully agree that some of these little discourse markers are not fully meant to convince. They're actually sort of what's called idiom. You know, you say yes, but, which means that it should be some counter, but sometimes it is not counter, so you're jesting or not actually convincing. It's also language specific. But is in Dutch is maar, which is used as but also used in another meaning. It's also meant it's all in the meaning of only. It's I'm only 1.60 meters. I'm but 1.60 meters. You would say in Dutch. So it's also a sort of multi-meaning. And sometimes we can encounter that because the but in the connective way is and the argumentative way is used in the front of a phrase, and this other but is this other maar is used in another place. But you're right that the function is not always convincing or really argumentative. If you look at small children, they use a lot of argumentative things in situations that are not but, using the button as a counter argument. In most cases, I think they do. And in these most cases, that's what I'm concerned about, because if we have 1,000 or 1,200 rule lines, a protocol, I'm not that interested in some cases that this but was not really argumentative, but in most cases it will be, I think, and I'm interested in the general situation, because I think that if a dialogue is really argumentative in comparison to another dialogue, then there will be a lot of buts or howevers or these kind of discourse marks in general. And I'm not that interested in a very small exception. But there will be exceptions. I think I fully agree. And it's a lot of discussion about it. Linguistics are actually very focused on these exceptions. If you read Schifrin, you will see that she's discussing a lot of ways of how these words are functioning, but also giving a lot of exceptions. I think for the social sciences, for educational science, it's more interesting in sort of general idea of how much and how situation, but you could disagree about that, of course. If you look at the sheets 13 and 14, you will see our dialogue acts. There are 26 of them. You see on the code part what we use. So the first argumentative is about reasoning. And you see some examples of discourse markers we use. We use a lot more than here are just examples. Actually, we have 1,250 rules for all 26 of them. So we have a lot of phrases which indicate or might indicate argumentative or responsive or informative. And as you can see, we have some subcategories for every cognitive function category. Things like conclusions, does or so, or elaboration like and. And these are the argumentative things. But of course, argumentation is more than only giving arguments. It's also about agreeing about arguments, and that's the full argumentative process. So we are really also interested in responsives, agreeing about confirming and denying the things, the arguments that were given. That makes the full process. And also about the informatives, about the transfer of information, of content information, and elicitives, checking questions, verifying questions, and several sorts of that, and imperatives, but they're not that important in our dialogues. So we did do that a lot of it. In slide 15, you will see we made two production systems, filters as we call them. One production system to segment dialogue utterances, the chats. We mostly, not only chats, but in most cases we analyze chats. And a chat message is longer than one utterance. So we segment, segment in different lines an utterance depending on the meaningfulness of the utterance. So if somebody says, yeah, but I don't agree, then we segment that in two messages, the yes, which is the confirmation, and but I don't agree as the second message. And that's, well, I think in a lot of languages we have the yes, but thing. First you agree and then you say how you disagree. But it's quite different than saying but in or no but. So it's quite different. So this confirmation, this kind of polite confirmation at the beginning is important in the argumentative structure. So this segmentation filter has some 300 production rules and things like question marks, punctuation marks, but also connectives, which are recognized before, and then split on that in these chat messages, and then the dialect coding filter, which is 1250 or something production rules. That's interesting that we have a sort of catch-all at the end. It's a sort of linear system, you could imagine. It's trying to code all things, and all things that it can't code, that the program can't code, will we code as information statement. Because interesting is that an information statement, for example, the statement, my cat is called Debbie, and she's walking here at this moment, and not meowing, Frank. My cat is called Debbie. It's just an information statement. We don't use discourse markers in information statements. So it's a question if it's really an information statement, or we do need some hand coding to code it as well. So these are the codings we use, and if you have questions or remarks, please give them.
One question is, are you with this system also use some contextual information, so what has been said before, or is that bring just the unit of analysis that is in going through these filters that is used to code?
Yes, we have a little bit contextual information, and it's for the codes that are in the responsives, in the replies. Because there's a little information about the context that should be a sort of elicitive before we specify it as a reply. If you say yes to a question, it's something different than saying yes if somebody just gives some information. So we specify replies as a answer to a question or a proposal, an elicitive, and we have general confirmation if people confirm information in general. For example, a nice discourse marker I always think is O, which is very specific, because it gives some information about how this knowledge state, how this knowledge is being addressed, and you, in some situations, well, you can't do this in a reply, but it's interesting that when we say, when I say, my cat is called Debbie, if you say, oh, it gives some information, oh, I didn't know that, and I don't care, but I didn't know that. So I just accept this information. If you should say, yes, I know, it's kind of a different situation. So the context is not only in the utterance itself, but also in the way you use this information. You acknowledge and you say, well, I didn't know that, but I accept it, but you don't disagree about it. If you say, oh, but if you know a lot more about my cat in this situation, you will say, well, yesterday you said it was another name. So we use some contextual information, but it's very small, only in this situation. Okay, thank you. If there are no other questions, I will continue with the research we did on this automatic coding system, and we continue to sheet 16 or slide 16, the reliability and validity of automatic coding. Actually, for this article we specified and you have read, we did some lot of trouble to make it acceptable, in the sense that we did some very far going reliability, also validity analysis. An article of Rourke and Anderson, 2004, said that validity of coding should be involved in three ways. Of course, you have to see if the coding is reliable, but you should also see if the coding is actually measuring that what it should be measuring, and if the coding is valid. And they suggested three ways to do that. You could say, well, if you know something about special groups, you could see if your coding is actually distinguishing between these groups in the way you would expect from theory from the, or other research from these groups. Another way of validity measuring is by experimental intervention. You should change the situation, and you would expect beforehand that this change will actually be seen or to be measured in the way people react, and it should distinguish in this aspect. And the classical construct validity, you could look at other measurements in which the way this coding system is correlated to the other measurements that are similar or way. So what we try to do is do the same kind of things that in classical measurement, statistical measurement is being done. We did that with this as well. But of course you can ask, is this necessary? Should you have the same kind of reliability or validity questions in manual interpretive or systematic coding? What do you think about that? I don't see a hands that someone wants to discuss that. But actually, I was a little bit worried about when I was thinking about it, that for a lot of coding systems, you don't see any results about what you see is results about reliability or validity question. We had to do it for the automatic coding system. Full agree. I think that's correct. I think it's also very interesting, but it's remarkable that for a lot of manual or interpretive coding systems or systematic systems, people don't talk much about validity, and they give some information about inter-rater agreement, and sometimes people only say, well, we had a second researcher and we discussed our disagreements. I think personally, I think that's a little bit of a pity, because a validity study will be very interesting for your own coding system. In regard to the time, I will go very quickly through these systems, because I was also want to talk a little bit about the last question, how can you use coding systems? Let's see, Frank.
Yeah, there was just a question coming to my mind when you were talking about validity. So obviously one way for validation is to relate your coding to an external criteria, say learning outcomes and let's say a knowledge test or something like that in the end. And well, I think we often had the question in the end, if we have the coding, no matter if it's hand coded or automatic coding, we have the coding of the process of the argumentation, and then we have some outcome data, and the correlation is very low. What does that mean? So is that your process coding was not valid, or could it not also mean that your outcome measure is partially invalid, and maybe your what you coded there could be quite valid actually, but your outcome measure was something that is not related to what they did there in the process?
Yes, I fully agree. And well, I always have the same problem. So if we don't know how valid our outcome measure is, but we also don't know how valid or our observation measure is, then we have a sort of correlation or a lack of correlation, which doesn't say something. Sometimes even our coding system is similar to our outcome measure, and we will have a sort of artificial high correlation. I've seen some research also on that. So I think there should be more interest in validity studies of coding systems. But of course, it's a lot of work and it's very difficult to publish. So I also understand why in a lot of cases it's not done. So what we try to do is do some reliability and validity studies. If you look at the slides 18, of course, reliability is not stability in this sense in an automatic coding system, because the computer program will do the same thing all over again in the same way. So you will have 100% agreement on your own coding. So that's different. But we compared it to manual coding of the same system, that is the same 26 dialogue acts by a hand coding researcher. And then we find a very high and 96% agreement and a coherence kappa of 78. Our validity studies are perhaps more interesting because we thought, well, if you look at the theory or research on girls and or boys in collaboration, you have a lot of research about differences between girls and boys, so you could expect to have some different discourse acts, dialogue acts in both groups. So groups of boys will be a little bit different than groups of girls, and we specified some differences about it. Girl groups are supposed to be more supportive to each other, more confirmatory, and boy groups, and we see that also very much in our data, are seem to be more negative to each other, more a little bit more aggressive. But if you look carefully, you know that it's also a little bit of sort of language they use, the way they use it. And we found some very similar differences in our dialogue acts. The thing that we didn't expect to find is that girls are argumenting a lot more than the boys as well. So they have more arguments and they use more argumentative structures in their discourse. Sadly, or not sadly, but remarkable, that was not repeated in the end results. So they didn't write better essays, the girls, but they did use a lot more arguments in their discourse. And that's one thing, as Frank already said, the what's happening in the collaboration will not specify or reflect immediately in the learning results. The other way is the experimental intervention. We have a participation tool. I will skip that. Please read if you're interested. And we had some confirmation on this difference as well, that the use of the participation tool did get some more argumentation and some more proposals as we expected in our discussion. And by correlational analysis, we had also a manual coding system, and we expected some manual codings to be correlated with the automatic coding. And yes, that was also partly confirmed, not fully and not very high, I must say, differences between the manual coding system and the automatic coding system. But they weren't the same, so that was to be expected for a while. But there was some confirmation, and as in a normal construct validity study, you don't expect full 100% correlation, because otherwise you wouldn't have to do that much trouble. You try to find similar measures, not the same measures. So yeah, the use of automatic coding, sheet 26, of course for analysis, also for assessment, and for online feedback. I think Martin, who just left, already mentioned that you can also use it in direct feedback. We try to do that. Perhaps you think of other uses of automatic coding, so I wait a little time if somebody wants to talk about it, other use they think. Don't see hands. So, well, about the assessment is quite interesting because we we use the system also on essays, on argumentative essays. The children had to write in this same historical assignment. We did that study several times. And we had, it was for a real assignment, so the students had to do it in for her last, how do you call it, last assignment for their school. So it was really important. So we had a teacher evaluation. We didn't mess with that. The teacher evaluated the essays as he thought was fitted. But we also did some automatic coding on the same essays, just counting the number of argumentatives in the essay. Very simple, doing the same program on the essays. And we had historical experts. Quite interesting. We had and the historical experts were historians who didn't know the children and assessed the essays. Quite interesting. We had a very high correlation of the historian experts and the automatic coding system, but no correlation at all with the teachers. So the teacher assessment was quite different from the automatic and from the historian essay experts. That's amazing, we thought. And of course we went into that and we tried to find out what was happening. And the teachers were using information about the students in their assessment. They said things like, oh, these students are so good in general. Now I'm really disappointed about their essay. So I give them a lower mark. I didn't expect them. Oh, what good it is, because mostly it's quite bad what they do, and now they're so fantastic. So they used a lot of development in their coding system. And of course, the historian experts didn't know the students and couldn't use that and only looked at historical reasoning. Actually, there were researches on historical reasoning. So our automatic coding system was in concord with that, but they didn't assess as teacher in general do, because they use also different information about their students. But of course, you can use automatic coding also on online feedback. We use that in a program. We use the same 1250 rules in a program that gave some information about how much agreement or disagreement students were in. So they looked at utterance like no and but and that sort of thing, and there's more disagreement, and more yes and I agree on that, or more agreement. And if you look at slide 27, you will see a sort of chat thing. If you run the PowerPoint, you will see it move. It's a sort of simulation. It will move from the left to the right and back again. If you look there, it's more to the discussion part or more the agreement part. So the program showed the students if there are more in disagreement or in more agreement to each other. So the chat box was going around that. And we were wondering if that helped, and actually it did help, because the students were saying that they communicate more easily, were more constructive and critical to each other, experienced the collaboration more positively, and had less problems in getting to have a shared understanding, which was also expected, because the program already showed that. It was very nice effect, and it had also some small effects on the group product. So yes, we used them in an online feedback system, and it helped a little. So that's the end of what I want to discuss. I think we are quite on time, so if you have remarks or questions, please.
Maybe I go first. Could you say a couple of words about the possible use of the MIPA tool outside of the Dutch language, or, well, let's say in English or German? Would that be a big step to further develop it. So you, I guess you have to redevelop all the production rules, more or less.
Yes, you have to distinguish between the MIPA program in itself, and you can use that, and it is being used to, in a lot of, by a lot of people all over the world in whatever language they can. You can use, you make your own coding system, so for manual coding it's no problem. Of course, if you want to have the same kind of production rules, then you would have to do some translation, and of course Dutch is different from German and different from English, so there will be other words which are important, but it looks quite similar. Actually, I was starting to do some translational work, so if you want to collaborate on that, please do. You can get the file and we will talk about it. So if you're interested, I would be interested to make an English version or German version or whatever. But of course, the production rules itself are different. But the MIPA program, in its as such, is actually in sort of English of my own making.
I would also have a question regarding the production rules. Are your production rules intrinsic from the language? I mean, do they only refer to linguistic patterns, like you use but and so on, or are they also topic specific, because you know that the girls in the example at the beginning are talking about this and that topic, so you're also making production rules that are topic specific?
Oh, sorry, I thought Ron was first. No, they're not topic specific. Actually, we use the dialogue act filter in a lot of research, not only on this research, but also in other research on different topics, it doesn't matter. But we did make some automatic coding about topics. For example, we made some concept mapping, content mapping of concepts, and then of course with a very other system, we looked at how students use different topic words, and then it's very specific on the assignment. For example, in this case it would be about women and about strongness and that sort of topics, and we looked if there was some development in that. So we used content topics as well, content markers as well, but not in this research. So the dialogue acts are generally, but yes, they are in Dutch. Yeah.
Sure. I just wanted to confirm the reliability that was 96% between a human coder and what the system did. Was it one person, or was that against a couple of people? I find that really amazing.
You know, I must say it was one person. We explained the system of the 26 things, 26 dialogue acts, and give. But the person was not directly involved in our research. But it was one person. That's right. Yeah.
So while Ron is typing in his question into the chat, I was curious if you want to use the MIPA system or the automatic coding for automated feedback. Isn't it possible that students gamble the system if they just know that with a couple of buts and because they will receive high argumentation scores?
Yes, we of course. Actually, they didn't do that very much. We have another program in which they can. That's also in the sheets about the participation tool, and students who talk a lot get a bigger sphere. So they try it out. Yes, in the start they do, and they can. But actually, the students are collaborating, and they have other things on their minds, if you understand my meaning. They just want to get this task done. So they're not saying a lot of buts just to be, and we didn't say disagreement is better than agreement or something. It's just, we just gave them this information. We didn't say something about nothing instructional, but it had some effect. But of course you can you can how do you call it, cheat the system, but it doesn't help if you have this task to do, you know, and you have several lessons to do that, and people stop with playing around with these tools very, very quickly. They don't care a lot about it, or about the observers or researchers or whatever. So, no, it's not a big problem.
So meanwhile, Ron put his question into the chat. I'm wondering about assessing the quality of an argument. For example, a student makes a claim and then several students disagree with this claim. Some of the disagreement might be trivial and some of it might be very substantive. Can automatic coding approaches be determinations about the quality of an argument?
Very good question. It's a question we hear a lot, of course. It's about the quality of the arguments. That's a very good question. I think a computer program could never, or never, I don't know, but this program cannot assess the quality of the arguments that are used. Sometimes I wonder if that's really important. Of course, if you look at the argumentation, and sometimes people use very strange arguments, but actually, if they use argumentative discourse markers, they try to specify some reason. So they've tried to specify some something, and perhaps in our science, it's not the good reason, it's not a justified reason, but still they try to give some reason for something. So I think that's a different kind of analysis. I fully agree, but I still think that people use these markers as a sort of endorsement of the things that they want to say or to convince. Even small children use things like "but," and sometimes it has no actually meaning, but they actually try to convince something, not what we think their reason is justified, but they try to convince. So I think this question is more complex than it seems at first.
In my research, I'm interested in not only looking at individual utterances that members of dyads are making, but also episodes of metacognitive, sort of shared metacognitive episodes. So I'm wondering if using MIPA, would it be possible to add sort of this episodic element, or is it adjustable in that sense?
Yes, actually, we started with the coding of episodes in the hand coding system. The MIPA program, it's called multiple episode or something. So we distinguish two aspects: message coding or event coding. Every utterance is an event, so you can code that. That's a different kind of coding of episode coding than episode coding. Episode coding is a sort of state coding. You know, there's an episode of an argumentation structure or a whole bunch of codes. And actually, the MIPA program makes, you can distinguish between those two, and you can do the same kind of analysis on event coding, message coding, and episode coding. What we sometimes do is speak of argumentative topics or argumentative structures. We first do the dialect act coding, and then with hand we specify special topics they were argumenting about. So we have this episode coding as a second step.
Okay, I think because time is up for that webinar, and I still have two important questions to ask, two questions that we ask all our presenters. So Heisberg, the first question would be, how would you think is your topic about automated argumentation analysis related to the learning sciences? Why is that an important topic for the learning sciences? It's of course a kind of a definitional question with respect to the learning sciences. So why is coding and automated coding so important for the learning sciences? And the second question is, what would be, and you already gave a couple of examples, but what would be your recommendation for PhD students using automated coding of argumentation? So is it well, go ahead, try it out, and if it works, include it, or is that a different approach that you recommend?
Well, the first, your first question is does it has to do with learning sciences? Personally, I think I'm not, I think automatic coding is handy and it helps you to specify more concrete, more specifically what you want to code, because you have to specify it. It's helping you to get more specific. For the learning sciences, I think that we have too less attention on what's really happening in the collaboration dialogues in the learning matter. So that's why I try to generalize a bit about communicative markers in general. For example, these knowledge markers, how people, if we say, well, collaboration is about constructing knowledge, actually, there are not many studies, I think, which actually show how this knowledge is constructed. When does somebody else accept or learn the things that another person says? So by these discourse markers, some idea about knowledge status, argumentation, negotiation about knowledge is, I think, very interesting and relevant part of learning sciences. As for the second question, what could PhD students do? I think that automatic coding will help you to specify your coding system. It will make your coding system more specifically. So I would really recommend that. But and sometimes, it will also specify if it doesn't work. It will also give situation. Well, in this situation, we can't make this coding system that specific, that concrete. That so we have to specify it on another way. So it will help also in that way. For a lot of codings, we use automatic coding not as a full system, but as a suggestive system. For perhaps something is happening here. It will not code, but it will give some marker in the coding system. Well, here human coders should look at, for example, if there are conflicts, and if you have a lot of protocols, it would be very nice if you could find very much, very quickly, and all these protocols of thousands of rule lines or something, very quickly, where there are some conflicts between students, if you are interested in that. And automatic coding could help you, and that's what we call semi-automatic coding, to find these kind of episodes. It's a very small system. You could try to see when there are all kinds of utterances which are reflector or probably indicating, so it will help you get some, it will be handy to get quicker to these points of interest, and that's also a function of automatic coding. But of course, everybody should look at it and see if it helps for them or is useful.
Okay, Heisberg, we thank you very much. I learned a lot, although I have known MIPA for a long time. I learned something new today. I will tell you in a private conversation. I'm really interested in collaborating more in bringing this system also to our research, maybe others as well. Maybe we could have a quick round of feedback or saying bye-bye, and then Gijsbert should have the final word, and then we close the session.
So thank you very much from the LMU. As I said, I was in the webinar by Caroline Rosé and Armin Weinberger, and I wasn't sure what new you would present, but it was very interesting to see the knowledge-free and knowledge-based difference and the different levels you use when automatic coding. So I learned a lot too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to just say that I'd be really interested in seeing whether I could use NEPA for what I'm doing. So I'll definitely follow up with you if that's fine.
No, thank you. I've found this very interesting. And please mail me or contact with me if you want to know more or want to discuss things with me. I always like to discuss things about this. So, and if you want to have the NEPA program, use it or try it out, please send me an email and you will get a link to the website you can download. I must say it's a Windows program, and so it won't work on an Apple computer. I'm sorry.